From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's a wide-open tourney at Augusta National, ahead on Only a Game, a Masters update. Also, the Cleveland Indians plan to transform tweets into occupied seats, women's ski jumping achieves Olympic status, and how to parlay decades of losing seasons into a lucrative coaching career. Also ahead, recalling baseball's longest game in which heroic game-tying hits incurred the wrath of teammates.
Boggs drives in a run on the bottom of the 21st with a double, and he stands on second base and he looks into his dugout, and he swears to this day that he can't tell whether his teammates wanted to hug him or kill him.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Each spring, grown men throw their fashion sense to the wind and give their all to win a green sport coat. Today is day three of the Masters. David Dusek is the deputy editor of the Sports Illustrated Golf Group, and he joins me now from Augusta, Georgia. David, welcome back to Only a Game.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy will turn all of 22 years old next month. He is at an amazing minus 10 at this point in the tournament. Will he keep playing beyond his years?
Well, I think that Rory has certainly proven to us here at Augusta and those of us who follow golf week in and week out that he is more than just a flash in the pan. This is a gentleman who showed up at age 17 as an amateur at the 2007 British Open and nearly won. He's won golf tournaments on the European Tour. He's won on the US PGA Tour. And he even set the pace at the beginning of last year's British Open, shooting 63 at the Old Course at St. Andrews, the home of golf. And he's certainly setting a really a great standard for himself. He drives the ball very long off the tee. He's gotten some timely putting and good iron game. And right now, it's that 6 inches between his ears that he's got to keep under control at this point because, sleeping once again on the lead at a major championship, he's going to feel pressure. The expectation levels are going to keep ratcheting up. And winning the first major championship, everybody says, who's done it, is the toughest one. And Rory has put himself in a position to certainly be one of the leading candidates to win a green jacket on Sunday evening.
Jason Day ended round two at minus 8. KJ Choi at minus 7. Are these guys likely to give McIlroy a hard time today?
I think Jason Day got a lot of confidence out of his second round, and obviously shooting 64 should do that to any golfer. KJ Choi has been in contention at the Masters before. He's done as well as coming in third place. His 70 on Friday for him was also a really solid, good all-around game. The player that I, though, am sort of looking to potentially make a charge Saturday is going to be Jeff Ogilvie from Australia. And this is a guy who won the 2006 U.S. Open. He was paired with Phil Mickelson in the first two rounds, and he's got all the tools and all the talent to really, I think, win at Augusta National.
Tiger Woods, of course, has won the Masters four times, but it's been 6 years since his last win at Augusta. He made the cut. He's lurking, as is or perhaps was his wont. Do you expect a patented Tiger Woods run to the top of the board this weekend?
Candidly, I don't. I think that Tiger Woods, over the course of 72 holes, just isn't ready yet to put himself in a position to win a major championship. He's, in golf terms, been battling a two-way miss, which means you're missing tee shots both left and right. That, coupled with a putter that's been running very hot and cold all season, he's actually changed putters three times over the course of the season, putting three different ones into play, tells me that he's not 100% confident in his putting. And above anything else, you have to have the utmost control on the greens at Augusta.
Defending champion Phil Mickelson will probably find it tough to repeat his champion. He had a slow start, minus two going into the weekend. Do you expect Lefty to be able to make that up?
I think the Lefty has a much better chance of making it up and being in contention on Sunday afternoon than Tiger Woods does. He doesn't have to make up so much ground. I mean, he's going to be eight shots off when he begins his round, later today. And I think that he's shown that he can make up a lot of ground really fast. Last year on route to winning, he went eagle, and then almost eagled again on Saturday, eagle being obviously two under par for one hole. So that was five under par through three holes in the course of about a half an hour. He just catapulted up the leaderboard. It might be too much to ask for him to do that again, but he has so much confidence. There's literally a different way that he walks around here in Augusta once he's on the ground than at any other golf event on the calendar. So I think that if he's in the cut, and he's made the cut, and obviously he has, then Phil is in contention.
51-year-old Fred Couples won the Masters back in 1992, but by my count, that's 19 years ago. But he's 5-under after two rounds. What about his chances?
Good math. Fred Couples was quick to point out in his press conference on Friday that at some point or another, someone will break Jack Nicklaus's record for the oldest person to win a major championship. Jack was 46 when he won here 25 years ago. The combination of players who are extremely fit and the golf club technology right now, just he says, is bound to make that happen. He's age 51, and there's a couple things that Freddie has going for him. Number one, he's a crowd favorite and has been coming here for years. He knows the course extremely well. He's got a lot of comfort here. The other thing is that Fred's problem oftentimes is a chronic bad back. Now, with weather expected throughout the weekend to be in the high 80s, low 90s, it'll be very easy for him to keep limber and loose out there on the golf course, especially if they have to wait on some of the par threes. This pace of play is pretty slow out here. So that combination may be what it takes to actually put him over the top and keep him near the top of the leaderboard.
David Dusek is the deputy editor of the Sports Illustrated Golf Group. You can see his live updates from the Masters on Twitter at golfcom_Dusek. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Manny Ramirez, who was 1-for-17 with the Tampa Bay Rays this season, retired yesterday. Rather than endure MLB's rehab program, Ramirez had tested positive for a performance-enhancing drug during 2011 spring training and would have been suspended for 100 games had he continued his career, since it was his second infraction. The Boston Red Sox are now 1-6. They were apparently buoyed by their magical opening day dog and pony show at Fenway Park yesterday, and they beat the New York Yankees 9-6. Boston had previously dropped 6 straight games to Texas and to Cleveland. Despite their success against the Red Sox, the Indians will need all the on-field glory they can get. Cleveland was dead last in Major League Baseball's attendance in 2010, and along with a growing number of teams, they're attempting to lure fans back via social media. From member station WCPN, Eric Wellman reports.
As I'm walking to my first ball game of the season, it's hard to imagine this is the same park that sold out 455 consecutive games back in the 90s. How times have changed. These days, the Indians are offering buy one, get one free season tickets, among many other promotions.
We're standing right in front of the Indians social suite.
That's Rob Campbell, the Indians' brand new coordinator of digital media. And that's right, he said social suite.
It's suite 356, and it's on the third baseline, and it's got a great view of all the action on the field.
This season, the Indians have decided to reward fans who talk about the team on social media, things like Facebook and Twitter. Seats in the suite, which has an indoor and outdoor section, are free and invitation only.
So we're in the suite right now. It's a full suite, one of our larger ones. Has its bathroom, has its own private Wi-Fi network.
It's a cold, windy day, so the fans are sitting indoors. Lane Strauss is perched on a bench in front of a window that looks out on the field. Strauss works for an ad agency in Cleveland, and he likes the idea that the Indians are trying something different to get fans back in the stands.
I would think my 3 followers would hopefully, okay, maybe a couple more than that. 4. Yes, would hopefully think that we're having a fun time, and we are. It's a whole different way to think about being at a game, because you're not just watching the game, you're sort of trying to take in the whole experience and everything that's going on around out there.
Of course, when fans are tweeting about the Indians, the team can't always control the message.
I said it's a huge crowd here today, and so many of the people here are dressed in green and have numbers on their backs. Oops, those are empty seats.
What the Indians are trying to do is get fans talking about this team again. And the suite is just one part of the Indians' social media strategy. And it's a strategy that has buy-in at the highest level of the organization. Mark Shapiro is the team's president.
Social media clearly provides one of the most unique opportunities to connect directly and interact with our fans. So we're trying to do that, but not haphazardly, trying to do that at a strategic level.
To begin, the team encouraged the players, the coaches, and many in the front office to sign up for Twitter accounts. Then it prominently published their Twitter names on the web. Shapiro says there was some initial reluctance on the part of some people, including manager Manny Acta, but even he has begun to embrace the medium. At the end of the first inning, Rob Campbell says it's time for a promotion where fans can upgrade their seats.
So almost time for Tweet Your Seat.
They flash it up usually at some point early in the game on the scoreboard for fans to tweet their seat location to @TribeTalk. So
there it is.
There it is. And have the phone out and are waiting for the response.
It takes about a minute, and then the tweets begin to roll in.
All right, here we go. We got some. Keith KRB3B. Section 254, row E, seats 7 through 11.
We hop into the elevator and head downstairs to break the news to this Keith guy.
Congratulations, you won.
All right.
Keep your seat. There you go.
Thank you.
Four tickets for an upgrade.
Awesome. Thank you.
The Indians began to think more strategically about social media a little over a year ago when they sat down with Amy Martin. She's the founder of a company called Digital Royalty, which works with sports teams and celebrities across the country.
It begins with senior leadership really understanding and embracing social media and their willingness to get uncomfortable, because social media is truly counterintuitive to marketing as we've known it.
By counterintuitive, she means that marketing has traditionally been a one-way street, but Facebook and Twitter are creating two-way conversations. Martin says the Indians are among the most progressive teams in Major League Baseball when it comes to embracing social media. Others are the Chicago White Sox, the Kansas City Royals, and San Francisco Giants. Then there's the Seattle Mariners. For the first time this season, fans at Safeco Field have the option of ordering a beer with Twitter. Kevin Zelko came up with the concept. He's known on Twitter as MS Beer Vendor.
Usually a vendor walks up and down the aisles and is kind of trying to find the random customer. Now I can just look down at my phone, find a specific seat or section, and head there.
Back in the Indian social suite, the home team is getting its offense in gear following a rare triple play. Second baseman Orlando Cabrera sends the ball into the home run porch as the Indians take a 2-1 lead. They eventually win 7-1 to pick up their first win of this young season. Still, it's a little bittersweet given that fewer than 9,000 people were there to see it. That's out of more than 40,000 seats. It turns out, to this point, it was the smallest crowd in Progressive Field history. I can't help but wonder, isn't the best marketing not on Facebook or Twitter, but on the diamond? Again, President Mark Shapiro.
Well, there's no question when you look at our business priorities, the number one priority is to put a winning team in the field. But I also am a big believer that there's not, you know, one single thing that's going to turn the tide, and that all the work you're doing across the broad swath of the organization, it's 1,000 little efforts that make a big difference.
For Only a Game, I'm Eric Wellman in Cleveland.
I follow you and you follow me. We can kick it like one of the homies. Hit me on Twitter. Hit me on Twitter. I follow you and you follow me. We can
this
kick it like one of the homies.
Twitter.
Hit me on
exclusive.
Twitter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Fulham Football Club will not be overtaking Manchester United or Chelsea at the top of England's Premiership this season, but Fulham's team chairman, Mohamed Al-Fayed, has found a way to draw attention to the club anyway. He commissioned a statue of Michael Jackson, which now stands outside Fulham Stadium, the delightfully named Craven Cottage. When informed that some fans felt his choice of a statue of the so-called King of Pop was a bizarre, if not craven, choice, Mohamed Al-Fayed said, "People will queue up to come visit it from all over Britain. It's something everybody should be proud of. If some stupid fans don't understand and appreciate such a gift, they can go to hell. They can go to Chelsea. They can go anywhere else." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, losers who win, or are they winners who lose? But first, on Wednesday, the International Olympic Committee Executive Board voted to include 6 new events in the 2014 Olympics: men's and women's ski halfpipe, biathlon mixed relay, team luge, team figure skating, and women's ski jumping will now all be contested in the Games at Sochi. Of these disciplines, women's ski jumping fought the hardest to get in. Back in 2006, Didi Corradini, president of Women's Ski Jumping USA, told me of her frustration.
We think politics was at play. We feel as though these women are being discriminated against. We're not asking to add a new sport or a new discipline. We're just asking to include women in an existing event.
Didi Corradini is on the line again from Salt Lake. Ms. Corradini, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be back, and it's a better time to be back than the last time.
Absolutely. A Canadian jumper named Zoya Lynch said this week, and I'm quoting now, "I'm so accustomed to using words like frustrated, disappointed, and sad, it's about time I can use happy words, but it feels so strange." Have you been adding some new words to your vocabulary this week?
Absolutely. We've reacted with excitement, but I must say also with relief. We've also been a little bit numb because we didn't dare get our hopes up because they've been dashed so many times before. We're still pinching ourselves, the athletes and some of us, that this is actually for real, and we don't dare really get excited yet.
Until Wednesday, ski jumping and Nordic combined, which is ski jumping and cross-country skiing combined, were the only two events without women competitors at the Olympic Games. Now that list is down to one, Nordic combined, but female ski jumpers will only compete on the so-called normal hill in Sochi. Men will also compete on the large hill and in team competition. Is there still work to be done?
Absolutely. We have our work cut out for us. That's the next step, and we have to go back to the International Ski Federation to get approval for those. But unfortunately, it does mean that we're now not going to be able to get those until probably until 2018 Olympics, although knowing us, we may give it a shot for 2014 anyway.
February's World Championships were seen as something of a test for women's ski jumping. Women had already competed at the Worlds in 2009, but this time the IOC was watching. Were the women most concerned with the high winds and the fog in Oslo that day, or were they more concerned with the eyes of the IOC in the stands?
All of the above. We knew this was a critical event, that the women had to do well. They felt prepared. The fog, I was there at the bottom of the hill. The fog was so thick that the women could not see the landing, and they were literally jumping in the dark. So it is a miracle under those conditions that these women did as well as they did.
IOC Sports Director Christoph Dubé said this week that there were only a handful of good jumpers in 2009, but that by 2011, female ski jumpers showed, quote, a really wide increase of technical capability. Was he right?
These women were ready for Vancouver 2010. There is no question in the minds of the experts, the coaches, the jumpers. I understand they're taking that perspective because they told us no, and one has to have a reason to say no. And the women have improved, but we are just very thankful that it's finally happened. And there's no point in looking back. We made it, and that's what's important, and now we look ahead.
Before the Vancouver Olympics began, 26-year-old Lindsey Vann held the record for men and women on the Olympic hill. Are women good enough to compete against men in ski jumping?
Interestingly, in the past, women and men did compete against one another. There's no question but that the smaller you are and the lighter you are, the further you fly. So women make very good ski jumpers. Our best women can compete against the men in terms of being just as good and sometimes better, as Lindsey Vann was until Vancouver 2010. Her record was broken by a male in the Olympics in 2010.
Speaking of Lindsey Vann, she said this week that she might not still be competing by 2014. Who should we watch for then?
Well, Lindsey goes back and forth. When I spoke with her after she was asked a question by one of the local media folks, she said, you know, it is really such a mental sport. If I'm still enjoying jumping the way I am today, I'll be there.
You don't mean to suggest that there isn't anybody else that we should be watching for?
Well, we have some fabulous jumpers here in the U.S. We've got Jessica Jerome. We've got a young up-and-comer named Sarah Hendrickson, who is 16 years old. When I got involved in this 7 years ago, she was 9 years old. She is tiny, and boy, can this young woman jump.
I love the description of a ski jumper as an up-and-comer. That seems absolutely perfect.
She is.
Didia Corradini is the president of Women's Ski Jumping USA and the former mayor of Salt Lake City as well. Didi, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The NBA and NHL regular seasons are nearing their ends, and some coaches will soon be in the unemployment line, or unemployed on golf courses. But in each of the major professional sports, a select few coaches managed to avoid joblessness despite never winning a title. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports on the increasingly fine line between coaching success and failure.
Success can take many forms. Recently, Charlie Sheen has been summing it up this way.
Winning.
Lauren Mackler has a more nuanced definition. Mackler is a coach and psychotherapist who helps people achieve personal and professional goals and is the author of Soulmate, Master the Art of Aloneness and Transform Your Life.
Well, it's subjective, right? So it's defined and it's experienced by people in a lot of different ways. You know, some people, success might mean they have a certain amount of money or they have a certain amount of prestige. They might have a large circle of friends, fulfilling personal life, fulfilling career, rewarding career. So it's different for different people.
Sounds reasonable, but sports are not reasonable. And the ultimate definition of success for coaches in major pro sports is predetermined. Championships. Win them, and you'll always have a place in history. Don't, and you'll likely be forgotten, or worse, remembered for failing to win.
I would never hire somebody who's failed twice. I might hire somebody who failed once.
That's ESPN.com columnist Bill Simmons, who was a panelist at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference in Boston last month.
I don't understand how these guys, like their third, fourth time, why anybody would hire them. Teams are scared a lot of the times, and they're always going to gravitate toward the safest option over taking a chance.
That fear of the unknown has created a job market for coaches that's like a game of musical chairs played inside a revolving door on top of a merry-go-round that rarely lets people on or off. Championships stop the spinning, at least temporarily, but near misses can be even more powerful. Buffalo Bills head coach Marv Levy came up short in four straight Super Bowls in the early 1990s. Bob Matthews is a sports columnist for the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. He says Buffalo fans remained loyal to Levy and have done the same with longtime Sabres coach Lindy Ruff.
There's never been a big public outcry to replace him. It's been sporadic, and that's because the team is never down for long. I think he gets the most out of what he has, and I don't think to this point he's ever had the most.
Ruff took over as Sabres head coach in 1997. The next season, the Sabres went to the NHL's Stanley Cup Finals, but haven't been back since. Matthews says 10 winning records in the last 12 seasons and deep roots in Buffalo ensure Ruff's job is safe, but it might be different in a bigger city.
He'd probably be gone by now because the fans do have less patience. Management has less patience. And just easy to get rid of guys in a major market. But here he's part of the community.
Jerry Sloan retired earlier this season after 23 years on the bench for the Utah Jazz. Sloan led the Jazz to consecutive NBA Finals appearances in 1997 and 98. It was as close as Sloan would ever get to a title, but Bill Simmons believes the Jazz were right to stick with him.
I thought Sloan was a great coach. I mean, a lot of this is luck. Phil Jackson got to coach Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant, and he's had loaded teams for the last 20 years. I mean, he's a really good coach, but he also coached that Lakers team 2 years after Shaq left that went 42-40. He wasn't that good of a coach that year. So, your talent's going to determine how you do.
There's no question Sloan was a regular season success. He's third on the NBA's all-time wins list. But did he last so long because small market sports spotlights have a lower wattage? Maybe. But Philadelphia Eagles coach Andy Reid is still employed after 12 years on the job without a title. Michael Bradley is an online columnist for Philadelphia Magazine and a contributor to the Sporting News and Athlon Sports. Our conversation began with a simple question. Andy Reid, winner or loser?
He has to be considered a winner. He has his longevity in Philadelphia would demonstrate that. His success to a point, 5 NFC Championship game appearances, 1 Super Bowl appearance, several division titles, a consistent run to the postseason. It may not be the ultimate winner, but he is certainly a winner.
Bradley says there's another measure of success for consistent coaches like Reed and Jeff Fisher, who left the Tennessee Titans after 16-plus seasons and one losing trip to the Super Bowl.
When you fill the seats with a waiting list, when you're getting home playoff games for your owner, when you are helping the team sell merchandise, you get success so that a new stadium is built, all of this jacks up the value of the franchise.
Bradley says more Philly fans are starting to turn against Reed, but change isn't always the answer. In 2006, San Diego had its best regular season ever, made the playoffs, and fired head coach Marty Schottenheimer after the season. The results under his replacement, Norv Turner, have been similar. Lots of regular season wins and playoff disappointments. Lifelong Chargers fan Cameron Slisher says he's seen plenty of losing seasons, so he's grateful for the last several years, but he's in the minority.
Now, I will say for most fans, I would say it's been too long. They forget, and they just want to, you know, gut the team and start over and see what happens from there.
The dividing line between coaching icons and infamous also-rans might be Bobby Cox. Cox spent 29 seasons as a Major League Baseball manager. His second stint with the Braves started in 1990, and when he retired after last season, he was praised as one of baseball's greatest managers. Cox got Atlanta to the World Series 5 times, but won just once in 1995. Atlanta resident and Braves fan Jerry Matheny says it was disappointing to only get one World Series trophy out of the Braves' 14 division crowns under Cox, but he never wanted another manager.
I would stick with Bobby because he's the one that got us to the big games to begin with. If he hadn't been in there finding players and playing the percentages and being a solid decision maker day in and day out for all those years, we wouldn't have been there to begin with.
Since he was glad to see one World Series victory under Cox, was Matheny surprised in 2007 when the New York Yankees let contract negotiations get in the way of re-signing Joe Torre, who led the team to 4 titles?
Well, I don't know. Atlanta said goodbye to Torre.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think of it that way. That's right. So we've reached the musical chairs revolving door merry-go-round again. Jerry Matheny's right. The Braves did say goodbye to manager Joe Torre, firing him after the 1984 season. But who did Torre replace? Well, that would be Bobby Cox, who Atlanta fired in 1981. All of these close calls can be tough on loyal fans, but success coach Lauren Mackler says fans who are completely enraged by a coach's failures tend to have their own shortcomings.
And they project a lot of their own stuff, their own failures, their own frustrations about holding themselves back and really going for it in their own lives. And if you can beat up on somebody who's fallen short, you get to feel better about yourself.
In the end, maybe championship-starved coaches should take a cue from Marlon Brando's Terry Molloy, who would have been happy with something they've already gotten, a shot at the title and a little name recognition.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
Trouble-free tomorrows, may your sorrows all be small. Here's to the losers, here's to the losers, here's to the losers. Bless them all.
What a bunch of losers. You're listening to Only a Game. Only a Game's Facebook community has grown no little and quite some this week, in part perhaps because I promised in last week's show that we would gather around associate producer Doug Tribou's glowing monitor to welcome new arrivals. Our friends now number over 1,000. We're still some 6,999,000 short of Leo Messi's alleged follower total, but then he's a star soccer player for Barcelona, and we're not. Walter Eugene Bowen posted as follows, "Once again, Only a Game proves that it's the best sports radio show on the air. You don't even have to be a sports fan to enjoy it week after week. My conversation in last week's program with Tabiti Boone, the fellow who turned his back on the opportunity to play big-time college basketball in order to care for his infant daughter, inspired lots of responses. Your story on Tabiti Boone was awesome, Robert McKee wrote. The rest of the show was as good as always, but that was an inspiration. Annie Whitney agreed. She wrote, "Thanks for introducing me to Tabiti Boone. My life includes only the smallest amount of sports watching, so where else but only a game would I have met Tabiti?" My commentary on onlyagame.org about the wretched way in which the Boston Red Sox have begun the baseball season provoked a bit of gloating via Facebook from Andy Vinciquerra. He wrote, "It was a magical night watching my hapless Indians shut down the mighty Red Sox. It doesn't happen often, so I'll enjoy the victory." Among the emails this week was an observation from Roger Perreault, who lives in Montreal. "I find that both the host and the regular commentator, Charlie Pierce, are entertaining and occasionally off the wall," he wrote. "But when I went to the website, I found that neither Bill nor Charlie resembles the images in my mind's eye. Bill looks like a kindly version of Mr. Dress-Up, and Charlie's a double for Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak." Mr. Perreault's assertion sent me searching for an image of Mr. Dress-Up, who used to host a children's TV program. For the record, Mr. Perreault, I have never worn a bow tie. You, too, can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only A Game Radio. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. And we still welcome postcards at Only A Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
At Gal Shields Academy in Scottish Borders, Scotland, the physical education class frequently means soccer. On a recent day at Gal Shields, it meant soccer interrupted by worms falling from the sky. "They just kept coming down," reported PE teacher David Crichton. "The kids were laughing, but some were covering their heads and running for cover. The falling worms made, quote, a wee thudding noise," according to Mr. Crichton, who could find no explanation for the phenomenon. "I spoke with the science department here, but none of them had an explanation for it. One of them thought it might have been a freak weather thing, but it was such a clear, calm day. Except for the falling worms." I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Convincing evidence that there can be such a thing as too much baseball, especially when it's 3 a.m. and cold. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Let's start with two quick college basketball questions. Was the men's final in which UConn beat Butler the least appealing basketball game you've ever seen?
It's certainly the least appealing championship basketball game at any level, including Biddy, that I've ever seen. Yes, indeed. It was a big, steaming cauldron of fail.
And
however, Washington State, 1941, which held the record for offensive futility for 70 years, Bill, is finally off the hook. Thank you, Butler Bulldogs.
And question number two, was the women's final between Notre Dame and Texas A&M the best final ever that didn't include a number one seeded women's team?
It was a pretty good game, I have to admit, and it was really good to see teams from at least the one and a half tier of women's basketball both playing for the title.
Back to the men's final, Charlie. UConn coach Jim Calhoun will start next year with a three-game suspension for NCAA rules violations. Many have wondered why Coach Calhoun will serve that suspension next season instead of serving it late this season when the games would have had a greater impact. In fact, Calhoun is one of those who've asked that question. Wait a minute. Am I got that right?
Yeah, he's now saying that he offered to take three games off this year, but the NCAA insists he take them off next year. He's backing and filling at this point at a tremendous rate, because if the NCAA is really going to sit down and talk to Nate Miles, who is the player around whom all the current allegations are swirling, Jim Calhoun's in deeper trouble than he was before, and he knows it.
U.S. District Judge Susan Richard Nelson said this week that she will need, quote, a couple of weeks to decide whether the NFL lockout is legal. In the meantime, she hopes the league and the Players Association will come to an agreement before such a decision is necessary. You want to handicap that proposition?
She's given them a chance. And basically, she also told them both to shut up, which is probably the most popular.
Speaking for millions of
the most popular ruling by a federal judge in a long time. The problem is they can't decide where the talks were going to be and who's going to supervise them. So my answer to Judge Susan Richard Nelson, who probably wants this off her plate at this point, is get ready. It's coming back to your plate.
What the NFL needs right now, Charlie, is a warm and fuzzy football story, I think. So would you like to tell everybody how William the Refrigerator Perry recently reacquired his Super Bowl ring?
The refrigerator's health has been awful. He has Guillain-Barré syndrome. He has trouble getting around. He's using a scooter. His hearing's going, but he was not going to wear a hearing aid. Anyway, somehow his Super Bowl ring got misplaced or stolen or sold, and he was contacted by the family of a 10-year-old boy from Pittsburgh who used $8,500 of his college money to buy the ring and then found out that Mr. Perry had been sick and gave it back to him, which is really nice. And, you know, it's so warm and fuzzy that I'm sitting here wondering how it is a 10-year-old already has $8,500 for college.
The Boston Red Sox are off to their worst start since 1945, but never fear. Charlie, Red Sox Nation is still behind the team, right?
No, the ticket prices have slumped 40% because of the worst starting record they've had since after VE Day, and they don't have a world war to blame it on this time.
Meanwhile, the Baltimore Orioles seem well on their way to breaking that streak of 13 consecutive losing seasons, but veteran second baseman Brian Roberts says the team isn't quite ready to claim the pennant yet. I think probably that's wise. What do
yes,
you think?
They are going to return to stinkhood at some point this year. I have no doubt.
For the first time in franchise history, Vancouver has won the President's Trophy, which is awarded to the NHL team with the best regular season record. Can the Canucks turn this first into something bigger, say, a run at the Stanley Cup?
Do you know anything about the Vancouver Canucks, Bill, besides the fact they play in British Columbia? I do not. This is a happy surprise for
me. Absolutely.
I presume since they're the best team in their particular conference, they probably can win the Stanley Cup. I'm hockey guy that way.
Another team hoping to kiss Lord Stanley's chalice this June is the Washington Capitals. The Capitals were ousted by Montreal in the first round last season, but they hope to turn things around this year by asking their best player to play worse. Wait a minute, did I misread that?
To play more under control. Yeah, they're asking Alex Ovechkin to try not to be the scintillating jump-out-of-your-seat player that he's always been his entire career and go back to the basics. This is compared by hockey observers to what the Detroit Red Wings had Steve Yzerman do early in his career. And Ovechkin says, of course, it's good when some people are going to compare us with Detroit, but they won the cup, right? We'll see what's going to happen. You know what that means? Yeah, I'll do this for half a season. And if it doesn't work, my butt's going 1-on-4 again.
What's the likelihood that someone other than the Chicago Bulls' Derrick Rose will be voted the NBA's most valuable player this season?
Well, I think it's still possible that it may go to one of the established name brands, but right now, the way Derrick Rose played against the Celtics the other night, he is the most important player in the league right now.
I assume that one of your objections to soccer, Charlie, is that sometimes the players flop or dive, and so I can only imagine that you're pleased with the new shin pads offered by the British design firm Small Fry.
Yes, they have built-in sensors and magnets that can sense if someone falls without being touched by another player and sends an alarm to the referee. Someone is going to get electrocuted by these. You watch. It will be a player or somebody who dives in front of him or one of the referees will get lit up like a Christmas tree at some point. I don't trust this technology.
Most kids whose pleas for a pony go unheeded end up with a bicycle or a skateboard. But what do you think of the German teen Regina Mayer's attempt to cope with her disappointment at not getting that pony?
I'll tell you what. You bloom where you're planted, and a carpenter never blames her tools, and Regina Mayer taught her cow, Luna, to show jump. And there is photographic proof right here. And Luna's form is not bad.
Is here where we say, I've never seen a jumping cow, I never hope to see one, but I can tell you anyhow, I'd rather see than be.
Exactly. And not only that, in the background of the photo, you can see a dish running away with a spoon.
And finally, Troy Tulowitzki of the Colorado Rockies had invited fans to vote for the song that would be played as he approached the plate. The fans chose Katy Perry's Firework, but after going 0-8 to start the season, Tulowitzki switched his walk-up song to Justin Bieber's Baby. So, do you expect other major leaguers will soon be catching Bieber fever?
Well, the real tragedy here is having switched to the miserable piece of pop belly button lint that is Justin Bieber, Tulowitzki started to hit the ball.
Wait a minute, the phone lines are lighting up.
Tulowitzki started to hit the ball, which means those people going to the Rockies games this year are going to have this inflicted on them for 82 games. Charlie. Doesn't anyone remember Otis Redding? Holy jumping cow!
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, various other books as well. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Paul.
There is no clock in baseball, and most of the time most players and most fans regard that as one of the game's charms. But as April 18, 1981 gave way to April 19th, lots of the players and fans involved in the game taking place in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, began to wonder if maybe a buzzer or a bell indicating that time had run out would have been a good idea. In Bottom of the 33rd, subtitled Hope, Redemption, and Baseball's Longest Game, New York Times columnist Dan Barry tells the story of that long, cold, unresolved encounter between the Pawtucket Red Sox and the Rochester Red Wings. Dan Barry joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Obviously, nobody knew when that game on Easter Eve in 1981 began that it would be the longest ever, but does it seem to you marvelously ironic that the game didn't even begin on time?
That's right. In retrospect, people really ponder that, but you're exactly right. The game was supposed to start at 7:30 on Holy Saturday night, which was also Passover, but the ancient lights were malfunctioning, and one went out. And then another one went out, sort of like a Morse code of failure, and a technician named Killer went into the electrical room and jiggered around with some knobs and stuff, and was able to get one of the lights back on, so they were able to play. But that didn't happen until 8 o'clock.
The Pawtucket Red Sox and Rochester Red Wings played 32 innings over the course of 8 hours. When researching material for this book, did you get a sense of when somebody in one of the dugouts might have first turned to a teammate and said, "Boy, this game is taking forever"?
Yes. Now, the conditions weren't exactly welcoming. It was very cold that night. But around the 15th inning or so, there was a comfort in knowing that baseball has a curfew, that it's written in the rules. The curfew is usually 12:50 a.m. And unfortunately, for some reason, that particular year, 1981, in the rules and regulations for the International League, the specific paragraph allowing for a curfew fell out of the text. It, like, fell onto the floor and rolled under a table, and it was not there. And so no one was really aware of this except the three umpires on the field. And so around 12:45, you know, the game is tied, it's cold, let's go home, it's already Easter Sunday. The manager said, "All right, well, we're done, right?" And the umpire said, "It ain't in my book. There's no curfew. We keep playing." And then around the 17th or 18th inning, the players began to say, "Hey, isn't there a curfew?" And then it was and then it was revealed to them that there is no curfew tonight, gentlemen. We're going to keep playing.
The players who participated in this game that lasted 33 innings were not certainly well known at the time. They were on their way up to the major leagues, but some of them certainly have become well known. What are the best examples?
Sure. Well, we can take two of them who made it to the Hall of Fame, which is pretty extraordinary. One is Wade Boggs, who got his chance with the Boston Red Sox in 1982 when Carney Lansford was injured. And Boggs goes on to hit more than 3,000 hits. He becomes perhaps the best hitter of his generation. whereas in 1981 he really wasn't considered much of a prospect. And then his Rochester counterpart at third base that night was Cal Ripken Jr., who was 20 years old. And, you know, part of baseball royalty, his father was Cal Ripken Sr., and Cal had grown up, you know, in and around Memorial Stadium, and I think even the cleats he was wearing that night might have been a gift from Frank Robinson. But you never know, you know, injury, you never know what will happen in the AAA. And, of course, we now know that Cal Ripken, the following year, actually that year, maybe a month or two after the end of the longest game, is called up to Baltimore, and he stayed quite a while, as I understand.
Set the record for most consecutive games played.
He did, at shortstop,
mm-hmm.
And not at third base.
By the time the game had reached, oh, say, the 27th or 28th inning, how many fans were still around?
As best as I can tell, at the game's beginning, there were 1,740 fans. By the 27th inning or so, there was maybe 20, and maybe a couple of cops freezing in the corners of the field. But that's it.
Was it the fact that the game trailed over into Easter morning that suggested the use of the word redemption in the subtitle of your book?
I have to say that it did. You know, I'm a struggling Irish Catholic, and I think about these things. But the idea that the game is played on Holy Saturday night and it tips into Easter Sunday morning, deep into Easter Sunday morning, and what you have on the field are men brought together from all over the country, and they all share the same goal, which is to get to the next step. And, of course, the fellow who wins the game, Dave Koza, he drives in the winning run sometime later, let's say. He never makes it to the major leagues. He becomes a truck driver. He develops an alcohol problem. He overcomes that alcohol problem. He's in recovery, 15 years sober. And to me, that is the redemptive part, mm-hmm. how you define yourself as a human being.
The game almost ended in the 27th inning, courtesy of a ball hit by Sam Bowen of the Paw Sox. Please read your description of that circumstance, beginning on the bottom of page 163.
Certainly. But then the Rochester pitcher, Umbarger, makes a mistake in his next pitch to the man who almost played for the Detroit Tigers. A ball right down the middle, and you just don't do that with Sam Bowen at the plate. He gets all of it. The sound of bat meeting ball cracking over the radio like a thunderclap. "Uh-oh," says Bob Drew, the broadcaster. The ball rockets out of the infield, bound for some distant place well beyond the left field wall. "Over the light tower," Wade Boggs will say. When he hit it, everyone was like, "All right," Pawtucket's clubhouse joker, Mike Angarado, will say. A lot of the players on the field put their heads down, Rochester's catcher Dave Huppert will say. They really thought it was over. A lot of them probably wished it was.
I wonder if the outfielder on that play, John Hale, was trying to will that ball over the fence,
oh,
just as everybody else in the park certainly was.
I know. And what happened there was, of course, Bowen, who had a lot of power, he really could hit the ball. And he hit it long. Hale just turned around, and he thought it was out. And then suddenly it is as though the ball hit an invisible wall, and it just sort of just glided down, and Hale just turned around, and it came into the basket of his glove. And I can't say that even Rochester was happy with the out.
Does the conclusion after 33 innings strike you as artistically satisfactory?
You know, the game is suspended, which is wonderful. The game is suspended on Easter Sunday morning at 4 o'clock. Joe Morgan says when he was a kid, he was told that on Easter Sunday morning, the sun dances on the horizon. And as Morgan told me, negatory, not true. People were exhausted. They weren't filled with, "Oh, we just played 8 hours." They were beat. And so I do find it satisfying. I find it satisfying that it ended in 18 minutes. You know, what had taken 8 hours now ended in 18 minutes. When no one was there watching those 8 hours, now there's 6,000, and it lasts, you know, as long as it takes you to get a glass of beer at the concession stand. And the fact that Koza hits the single that wins the game over Cal Ripken's head. You know, everybody remembers Cal Ripken No one really remembers Dave Koza. And so, to me, there is a sweetness and an art to it.
Dan Barry wrote Bottom of the 33rd, Hope, Redemption, and Baseball's Longest Game. It's published by Harper, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks very much for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Mark Filippino, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Bottom of the 33rd author Dan Barry, who observes that the players in the longest baseball game ever wanted just one thing.
They all wanted to go home.
Echoes of George Carlin. Didn't he say baseball is all about coming home? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'm going home. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.